from the University of Utah. He comes to us with a special branch of medicine called anaplastology. I had to look that up to see what it was. I don't remember being taught it in med school at all or residency, but he does fascinating work, we're looking forward to his talk. So, Paul, the time's yours.
Thank you. Also, a reminder, so I have made many posters, and I remember I was at a poster session where I think I had four people come and look at my poster. So just a reminder, these people put a ton of work into their posters. Go down the hall, take a right, and it's in the glass room. So I am not going to be offended if you do not stay here and listen to my talk. Go over and see their posters. I hope you gain a few things today. You'll learn about anaplastology. It is a unique profession. It's the jack of all trades, master of none type of profession. I'm going to show you a little bit what I do with 3D printing, and I'm going to list some steps how every one of you could be using 3D imaging in educating patients and things like that. So, and then lastly, I hope that you gain... I'll share some little anecdotes that I've learned. I've been practicing for 16 years now. So I'm still young, but I hope I've gained a few things working at the cancer hospital. When most people think about prosthetics, they think arms and legs, things that do not look real. And in fact, when most people think of ear prosthetics, they think of Mr. Potato Head. My job is, if I'm a really good artist, if I'm really good at my job, you'll never notice my work. So anaplastology is the artificial creation of something that goes on the skin. And we're kind of a conglomerate of many different professions, but we kind of gather around realistic prostheses. So some people come from the dental industry, medical illustration, some from prosthetics and orthotics, and a few come from special effects. Prosthetics have been around for thousands of years, and in fact, the first documented is this Egyptian toe that I saw in London, in a museum in London. And we also have documentation of prosthetic eyes that were made by Egyptians. And it's the belief that if you die missing an eye, you will not have an eye in the eternity. Tycho Brahe was a Swedish astronomer that studied under Kepler. He's not quite as well known, but Tycho Brahe is known for documenting the universe. And he lost his nose in a sword duel. And it was for one of two reasons. It was either over a woman or a scientific matter. The reason is debatable. And even in this little sketch of him, you can see he has this plate that's shaped. We'll talk more about this in just a second. So this is actually, the woman on the right-hand side is an American artist named Anna Coleman Ladd. And just after World War I, she went to Paris, France, to treat all these French soldiers that were wounded in the war. And she made these tin masks. So similar to Tycho Brahe, she made these tin masks with a really interesting process. So she'd sculpt in wax, and then they dissolve a metal. It's called electroplating. But you dissolve a metal in a solution, and then you apply a current to the solution, and then you'll have metal deposits on top of the wax. So it's a way to form metal without heat. Okay, and so they would make these tin masks, and then enamel them to match the skin. So that was about 1917 when that video was shown, and that's courtesy, by the way, of the Smithsonian Institution, as well as this photograph as well. So a very early orbital prosthesis is what we call an eye prosthesis. This was one of my first patients. This eye prosthesis was made in 1980, And typically dentists would work with these acrylics, these hard plastics, but they were translucent. So you could really create these to be a really good match to the skin. But the problem is they were rigid. And so they would usually attach them to glasses. They're rigid, and then they would be so heavy that the glasses would kind of slip down, and then you'd see a big gap in the side, and then people would be really embarrassed. So this gentleman, he had his eye, this orbital prosthesis made in 1980, and he wore it for one day and then never wore it again. I hope my patients don't do that. I hope they tell me they weren't happy with it, and they come back, and we keep working with it. So in the 60s, there were a lot of plastic surgeons putting, basically augmenting parts of the face. I mean, rarely do you hear about it nowadays using silicone, but they were using this new material that was, you know, elastic and very durable. And my colleagues caught on to that and started making facial prosthetics with silicone. Silicone was actually invented in the 40s by Dow Corning. Today's silicones, I have a sample, but it's over there. After the presentation, I'll let you play around with it. But it's amazing stuff. So imagine, think of a binky, an infant's binky, and the silicone on that. That's the same material that I use to make the prosthetics. So, I mean, you have to really, really pull on it. And eventually, these prostheses do break down over a couple of years. But it's mostly due to, like, color fading and a few other problems. But they're very strong. So how did I get in this profession? I had my friend's brother lost his eye in a golfing incident. You know, they yelled four, and he turns around and then gets hit in the eye. So it loses his eye. And then I had a relative who had melanoma and lost his ear. And so when I was in high school, I went to MD Anderson in Houston, Texas, to learn about the profession. And it took a couple of years getting into it. You know, it's a very small field. There's about 110 of us in the United States, approximately 450 in the entire world. So we just don't have a lot of patients. So it was a little bit difficult to enter, but I've made it so far. I use a lot of different education. So I studied art and science as an undergrad, and then I did business as a grad. Ultimately, we have you have on there. You'll see what the process is. Ultimately, we have a certification program. It's kind of a peer-reviewed a theoretical type exam that we use. My first prosthesis I made was in 2002 for this gentleman who had he created this kind of I'm going to say tin, but it was some sort of soft metal that he bent, and then he taped a Band-Aid on the top of it, and that's how he covered his nose. At the time, I was working in dermatology with Mohs surgery. I was a lab technician, and I was studying to do this. And this patient was there, and you know they kind of said, "Well, what have we got to lose? This is how he is. So can you make him something?" And so I was in the middle of my training, and I made him a nose prosthesis. And so this was the first prosthesis I ever made. It's not one that I'm super proud of, but that's how it goes. And actually, I always told this guy, I made him a couple of different ones. I always told him it was too red, but he always wanted it more red for whatever reason. This is when you work with people, you get to know them. I get to know the people really well. We spend a lot of hours talking about all sorts of things. And in the beginning, I used to be very hands-off on religion, politics, all the stuff that you're not supposed to talk about in a professional scenario, but we do. And so we get to know each other really well. So this is actually when he died, His family asked me, or he actually asked his family to ask me to do the makeup at the mortuary. So, which is a really neat, you know, it's a really neat honor for me. How do these attach? We can glue them on, or we can use essentially a dental implant and either snap it into the bone with a bar and clip type system, or we can use magnets or kind of a ball and socket system. We have lots of different options there. And the glue, so all of these prostheses are temporary. You cannot suture them to the skin or anything like that. But they're meant to be worn for a day. Some people sleep in them, some people do not. Some people go swimming with them, some people do not. It's all personal preference. The oldest, 94, the youngest, 3 years old. The young patients are, they are born with an ear defect called microtia, and I'm pretty well known for working with younger kids. Most of my colleagues don't work with that young of kids. You just have to work fast because they bounce all over the place. And then another interesting statistic is with cancer patients, right here, cancer patients, 3/4 of the people that lose their ear are men. So, and that's quite a few patients there. The prostheses I make range from about $4,000 to $11,000. Insurance does cover them. Granted, so Medicaid of Utah, Medicaid of Idaho will cover them. They just don't pay me anything. So anyway, it's a nice service for people. Most of the, it's probably about 50% are Medicare patients. Yeah, I could call out an insurance company that does not cover them, but I'm not going to. Anyway, this is pretty rare in medicine, but I can offer a warranty and a satisfaction guarantee. So that's a pretty cool thing that we just assure people that they will be happy no matter, we get paid a lump sum, and no matter how many times I see the people, all I care is that they're happy. So I don't get paid any more for it. A couple of years ago, we published one of our studies in a plastic surgery journal, and this talked about how satisfied patients were with their ear prostheses. And you can see the majority of people left, you know, happy with our service. And then this question is, How uncomfortable do you feel? How self-conscious are you in public with your prostheses and without? So this shows that, you know, the prostheses may not be perfect. I cannot do what nature does. But is it better than the alternative? Yes. So here's my workflow. And right now, the state of the art is this marriage between technology and conventional fabrication techniques. One day we could be 3D printing prostheses. And, you know, it's something that I'm working on, so I think it's possible. This is called photogrammetry. Photogrammetry is everywhere, okay? This was done with a smartphone. And it's a series of photographs put together, and then, you know, there's an algorithm that based on your perspective and the focal field, it stitches these images together into a three-dimensional model. And these can be pretty accurate. So believe it or not, photogrammetry is everywhere. You just don't know the name of it. So Google Earth, self-driving cars, they all have different names or different technologies, but it all falls under this kind of genre of technology, photogrammetry. So now we're getting into video and things like that. And I also, I'm just waiting for the day when I have a smartphone that has a camera on this side and a camera on this side, because it will be so much more accurate to capture these images. And I have already started doing virtual work. So, you know, so I just a month ago, I made an ear prosthesis for a 20-year-old in Romania. Okay, so that was never possible until technology. So we have some cool stuff that's happening in prosthetics and just this field of anaplastology as a whole. This is a 3D model I made. So, you know, just kind of a hobby. This is kind of a large section of the Wasatch Mountains here, and you can see all the different peaks. This is the Wasatch Front along Salt Lake Valley. But these are just data points, and all 3D technology is kind of an XYZ data point, and when you stitch them together, you have a 3D model. So I will take, we used to sculpt in wax. That's the thing on the left. I still do that every now and again. It's not a lost art. But I now do a lot of my sculpting with computers. And then I will print it. And right now I make a mold of the 3D print and cast that in wax. And then the wax shape allows me to adapt it to the patient's face, to fit it to the face, so it doesn't, you know, so there are no gaps and all that sort of thing when they smile and chew and whatnot. So eventually we will get to the point to where we're printing the prosthesis. Here's the hand sculpting process. When I started, I would spend, I don't know, 12 hours sculpting an ear, but now it's about an hour and a half. It's not perfect. It takes me the same. I always said with technology, the 3D printing has been around for 20 years. At least we've been talking about it. It was always too expensive. Computers were not fast enough, not robust enough. But and then printing was always, you know, $100,000 printers, and we just couldn't afford it. Now there's printers for $300, and this is totally in our hands, and it's in your hands too, and I'll show you in just a minute. So here's the 3D modeling. I already talked about photogrammetry. There's laser scanning, which is more detailed, and you have to have a stationary piece. You can't have a human that's kind of floating back and forth. And then also we can take CT, MRI data, cone beam CT data, and create a digital model of that. And actually, what's really cool about all the open source, so the patents expired on 3D printing, and that's why we've seen such a flood of this open source software and whatnot. And I think we will only, if you, you know, anyone in here in radiology, anybody, one or two, you know, you will see more and more applications with 3D in like within the software packages that, you know, that radiologists use. And I think that's being pushed by the open source industry. You know, it's they're pushing them to do all these different things with it, so that, well, it's bringing down the cost is the bottom line. So, this is a patient with Treacher-Collins syndrome, not a very common birth defect, but you can see the. I was using this to plan the location of the implants. So we put in some implants and made prosthetic ears for this girl. So I will pull this slide back up after. But you can take any CT scan. Some of them are not very high resolution. You can take any CT scan. All of this is free or open source. So the first one, Invisalius, is a Brazilian open source software. And it's compatible on Linux, Mac, and Windows, and that allows you to take the DICOM files, the images, and it will slice them, it'll compile them into your three-dimensional model, and then what we have is segmentation. So then you can choose the based on the density of the tissue, you can choose what you want to see. So, and then I use another free software called Mesh Mixer. It's free. It is proprietary, but they lure you into using other products. So, but that's been a great. It's a very powerful piece of software that you can then manipulate the CT file, the three-dimensional CT file, in lots of different ways. There is a company here in Ogden, White Clouds, that is amazing. I mean, they will let you go tour, by the way, and they love the medical application. So they would love to open the doors to you and just go take a tour. Take your family down there, and you will see just this massive, massive warehouse. It's on 12th Street. You'll see this massive warehouse of 3D prints of mostly architecture and things like that. It's fascinating. But you can also, I mentioned these, I have no financial interest in any of these companies, but 3D Systems in Colorado and Materialize, if you send them a CT scan, they will help you plan a surgery or even fabricate some sort of titanium plate for a reconstruction. So they do some really cool things, but it does cost. Mold making, it's gypsum. It's kind of like plaster of Paris. It's a mixture of concrete and plaster of Paris, okay? And then I take my wax sculpture that I've created from a CT scan or from or just sculpting. So I have the wax sculpture, and then I encase the wax sculpture in this plaster-like material. I melt the wax out, and then I inject silicone in its place, in the void area of the mold. And that gives me the shape of the prosthesis. And there's an art to that, too. There's a lot of painting that goes on in the inside. And I clamp the mold and wait for it to cure. The biggest challenge I have, as I mentioned, was coloring the prosthesis, which I do inside the mold. My biggest challenge is matching the color and translucency of the skin. You know, it's like when you're playing around with a flashlight and you stick the flashlight in your mouth and your cheeks glow bright red. So we have to hone in on that. Not only do you have to choose the right color of pigments, but you have to choose the right quantity of pigments in order to get something realistic. They're just on the note of translucency to the skin. We just try and follow the skin's anatomy in my painting technique. So I will layer up. I start with kind of a base layer, and then I do the melanin type layer, and then we have kind of a translucent yellow layer on top. I always think this is a great, by the way, there is no white skin, there's no black skin. It's all a shade of brown. These are two Mohs resections, one with type 2 skin and one type 5. And so, you know, African American and regular Caucasian, well, when you flip it over, the dermis is the same. What's different is the composition, the size of the melanin proteins that are produced in the skin that really creates the difference between the skin. So I had another study that I did with vitiligo patients. It's where your skin blanches white. It's an autoimmune disorder, and I measured the skin color of vitiligo lesions to create my base color in making prostheses. If that makes sense. So kind of like Home Depot, and where you go to match the paint color, I use that same technology. So this was part of the study. On the right-hand side, this is basically an array of pigment concentrations and then compositions, I guess you could say, different colors. So, and I try and create an average, and then I can adjust it to the patient from there. And then, of course, you guys want to see that I can actually do this work. So,
it's kind of big.
No, look at the other one.
So she's looking at her ear for the first time. She was born with microtia.
You like it? Yeah.
What do you think?
Squishy right here.
That's your earlobe.
Oh, this one's squishy too.
Pretty funny. So a lot of these microtia patients are reconstructed with rib cartilage or with like a med porous porous polyethylene implant, and it's just hard to do. I mean, you ask any plastic surgeon about that surgery, they'll say I had one surgeon I work with quite a bit, and she said it's the most fun surgery, it's the most artistic surgery, but it has the worst results because it's really challenging. If that's what people want, you want to do your best. But expectations can fall short, and unfortunately, I see the results of that. As you can imagine, prosthetics are really made for people where surgery is not an option. You'll see a lot more pictures like that. So here are the prostheses that I fit over the top of that surgical reconstruction. This was a surgical reconstruction from about 1950, maybe 52 or so, from a doctor up here in Ogden, actually. Interestingly, microtia patients are often very interested in sound. This guy was a sound engineer and was missing his ear, and he took some time off work, and when he came back to work, he had a new ear, and he shaved his mustache, and everybody asked about his mustache. So
Treacher-Collins syndrome.
Oh, this is the
lack
CT
of
scan
bone
that we
in the face.
Showed.
What Katie had instead of ears.
Some of the surgeries that we've done are to try and
cartilage.
Bring her jaw, both her lower jaw and her upper jaw, forward.
So this is the wax
to try
sculpting
and
process.
Give her a breathing space.
It looks bad right now, but you know, in
how
the
many
end,
surgeries,
it
Katie?
Turns out better
34.
Looking.
34.
Right now, we're just trying to find the right placement.
Fine, I'll
used
it.
To wear sticky ones on her face. Because she wanted to have earrings so much.
But once we get that final shape, then I make a mold of it and put silicone in its place, and then that cures in the shape that we desire.
She came up with Emma Watson, who played Hermione Granger in the Harry Potter movies.
I
wanted
someone to have ears for this. So, yeah, I'm really excited.
She is very, very excited.
We searched all over the U.S. to find somebody who could do prosthetic ears really well. We came back and found Paul right here in Salt Lake.
Just the finishing touches here.
Paul has kept her facing away from the mirror as he's been fitting them.
Go for it.
Phil?
Yeah?
She's going to feel like a princess.
I believe that she is on the earth to help other people see.
Beautiful, aren't they?
That she is as normal as they are, and then help them see through those eyes for other people that have difference.
You know, one thing that I think is very valuable, it's pretty hard to work with cancer patients, as I'm sure you can imagine. And fortunately, I'm on the recovering end of seeing them. And so people they can see the light at the end of the tunnel, sort of thing. They're starting to get back on track, and I hope I'm a step in that process to kind of continuing with normal life. But I have found some really interesting questions to ask. I like to ask, what's it like to, you know. Pretty open question. What is it like to have this, or to live with this? How does this impact your life? And then how can I help you? And I think those are questions that in any medical profession, you will benefit from asking. It's a little bit difficult. Well, it's very difficult, actually, to have true empathy for these patients. We just have no idea what they go through. And I will, when I do training courses, and when I train people, we make a nose that sits on the top of our existing nose, and then we go to Walmart or some sort of grocery store, just so people can feel what it's like, especially when you make a bad-looking prosthesis. You feel what it's like to wear a prosthesis in public. And anyway. What did this guy have made? So here's a sinonasal cancer, but unfortunately, people lose the eye with these. And then she had a flap that, I mean, it's sometimes the flaps don't go well. So she had a flap, and then she has an oral obturator. It's kind of like a modified denture that we attach magnets to, and then she can snap on the part of her face onto that denture. Okay, so she doesn't even use glue to attach this. And I asked this woman, so she lived about 2 years after her initial diagnosis, after her second diagnosis, okay? We anticipated about 8 years or 8 months left of life. She ended up having the big surgery and in the end lived 2 years. And probably about a year and a half into this process, I asked her, so knowing what you know now, would you have done this again? Would you have gone through surgery and everything? And it's pretty interesting because some people, you know, I have no idea how people cope with these things because I would, you know, I think I probably would not have gone through the surgery again. But I asked her, and she says, oh, definitely. And that's because she changed her life. You know, it's helpful when you know when you're going to die because you can repair relationships and just prepare, just kind of like our last speaker. She's prepared, and she's probably in a good way. You know, she's comfortable with death. And, you know, I mean, how many people have read Tuesdays with Maury? You know, I would hope everyone has. But there's a lot of life lessons that you share when you know your life is going to end. So this woman had breast cancer, radiation therapy to her chest, and then she had this mandibular cancer. And so then she had no option to reconstruct her mandible. They tried, but it didn't work. So this is a gunshot wound when he was very young, and he has since married a really cute girl. He's a mathematician, very, very smart kid, very, very, very motivated, and we are good friends over the years. This is a Catholic priest, and he has done a lot of I do training courses in Brazil, and he has actually sponsored a lot of them, or got the Catholic Church to pay for a lot of the patients. So it's really cool. So he's done a lot of good things. I see some burns. This was an oil-filled accident, and you know, after two-thirds of your body is burned, there's definitely a change in your life. And what we did with him was we took, here's a photo of him before his accident, but this is his boy, cute little kid, and he has some pretty big ears. So his dad said, I would like his ears. And so what we did was we took his ears, and this is where three-dimensional modeling technology is just a game changer, because I can take his boy's ears, scan them, and then it's simply, I mean, it's a one-button function. I can just increase the size of his ears to fit him, okay? So I increased them by maybe 20% to get the adult ear, and then print it. So there's the side-by-side with the boy's, the impression of the boy's ear, and then the print. And then the patient wearing the ear prostheses. So another, I think my international colleagues, they just call me when they're desperate, because this is another case that was in Brazil. And I worked with some dentists to create the prosthesis. It's kind of magnetically attached to her oral obturator, but she has these implants that go up in through the sinus into the zygoma. They're called zygomatic implants, and they just, I mean, there's not much holding them. They kind of flop around, but amazingly, the patients do pretty well, and she's able to snap that on. And I have a video. So although this is Portuguese, I think you can understand the clarity.
Ave Maria, cheia de graça, o Senhor é convosco, bendito sois vós. Entre as mulheres, bendito é o fruto de vosso ventre, Jesus. Ave Maria, cheia de graça, o Senhor é convosco, bendito sois vós. Entre as mulheres, bendito é o fruto de vosso ventre, Jesus.
Here I've been wearing a nose prosthesis the entire time, and you guys didn't even notice. That'll be fun going around. This is my largest prosthesis I've made to date. This was a patient, really cool story here. This was called Hands for Cosmos. Something like that, but I was involved in this where this community, really cool, kind of a church community in Springville, I think it was Springville. Anyway, somewhere in Utah County, they rallied around this guy who got both of his hands caught. Well, the first hand got caught in a meat grinder, and then he went in to get the second one and, you know, took off the other hand. And so, you know, pretty debilitated at that point. But I made some hands that slide on over his hand, and he does have. So he kept his two metacarpal bones, okay, and so he has essentially this function, okay, and so the prostheses I made, they look, you know, they're not the prettiest because I was rushed, but they're a pretty close match, and they function, and you wouldn't think about, you know, like. A lot of the stuff you'd say, oh, is there really a function to that? You know, it's mostly looks, but there really is a function to everything that I've shown you today, from hearing aids to glasses to oxygen tubes and, I mean, safety glasses. Those are all the ears, but, you know, keeping the defects humid so you don't dry out and bleed. You know, I could go on, but... you know, this enabled him to ride a motorcycle with kids on the back. Anyway, here's a woman who came to me. You know, she's, I think, 63 years old at this point. She's had her prosthesis for 3 years now. But she always had, she called it her aid, and she was born without the anterior portion of her foot. And I was able to make a prosthesis that fits over the top. So this is her wearing flip-flops for the first time in her life, which is pretty special for you. I mean, you wouldn't think that. You know, when I was growing up, we used to call those thongs. But. There's a lot of people that that lose their fingers. And I don't usually, I actually try and talk people out of making, of wanting a finger prosthesis, because there's a little adjustment time and most people adapt. So I tell people, for a finger prosthesis, you know, give it a couple of months, you know, maybe even a year for the swelling to go down, and then let's talk. If they haven't adapted, if they still want it, then I'll make it. I have found that when I make finger prostheses for people, a lot of the times they don't want it. You know, it's an interference. So I try and choose patients carefully there. Here's an interesting one. I have more of these kind of odd requests. This is a little cover. That's without the hair, okay? So I matched the hair. I matched a wig to her hair, okay? And then glued it onto that piece. So that's the prosthesis I made for her. And then that's the defect we're covering. This was a radiation defect where her titanium plate was exposed, you know, after radiation therapy following a brain tumor. I'm often asked about Halloween. Do I make stuff for Halloween? It's pretty rare because, you know, who wants to take their work home with them? But a couple of years ago, just as a challenge, I thought, you know, I'm going to sculpt someone famous. So I picked Lincoln. I'm kind of a fan of Lincoln. And this is me in front of the White House. I'm actually wearing a mask, and I have done the Centerville Parade a few times. Has anyone seen the Centerville Parade? Has anyone seen me in the Centerville Parade? A couple people. You wouldn't know it was me, and I'm not telling you that it was me, but anyway, it's kind of fun to do that. I call up, and they say, so what's your business? And I say, well, I don't have a business. You know, what's your organization or what's your association? I'm like, I don't have one. Why are you doing the parade then? Well, I like the U.S. Is that reason enough? You know. So anyway, it's kind of fun. And then about 9 years ago, I had a woman come to me after breast cancer. This woman, Brenda. I'll show you a video in just a minute. But I'm standing in the room, so I make the nipple prostheses. I made nipple prostheses for her, I'm sorry. She had a little bit of reconstruction and just felt like something was missing. So I make some nipple prostheses for her, and when you go through breast cancer, you know, it's kind of, you're kind of exposed to a lot of people, especially in an academic hospital. So, you know, she felt very comfortable in front of me. So I'm standing in the back of the room, and she puts them on, and she looks in the mirror, and, you know, she smiles. She looks up and smiles. She likes it, and then she looks up, well, catches eye contact with me, and then she blushes, and she pulls down her shirt. And she said, I felt naked again. And I saw that as just so impactful and such a great opportunity. I thought, there have to be so many people that deal with this issue. The number of breast cancer patients are just huge, a couple of years ago we started offering this service that's called Feeling Whole Again, because that's the overall comment that we have from these women, is they feel whole again, even though nobody's, you know, all the other facial prosthetics you've seen, that's very public, okay? This is not public. I will make an ear prosthesis for a 75-year-old man, and oftentimes it's, oh, it looks good, and then they walk out and they don't even say thanks. Whereas I make these nipple prostheses, which no one will see except their spouse, and they will just, they're sobbing, they're like, this is amazing, you know, and I think this is why I do this work. You know, it's for people like that who. It really impacts their life. It really impacts, you know, their psychological well-being. That's really neat to me. So,
and then we handcraft.
Here's the process.
Women love what they see, and more importantly, what they feel. when wearing their prostheses. That is just unbelievable. It truly is. They look like so real. It's amazing.
Wow. I can't even tell. That's wonderful.
Oh, that looks real. That looks very real.
Yeah. Yeah, that is perfect.
I wanted something that made.
Pretty fun to see a happy experience from breast cancer, isn't it?
Thank you.
Women glue on their nipples for about 2 weeks at a time, and they can be reused for years. Women exercise, swim, and shower with no worry of them coming off. It's as if they are a part of them.
It's your prosthesis. It's not some prosthesis that you buy out of a shelf. It's mine. It's my prosthesis, and it's not a prosthesis, it's my nipple.
Without surgery or pain or tattoos, women like Brenda are moving forward on their journey to feeling whole again.
When you put the nipples on, you don't see the scarring. You feel like they're yours. Mainly, it's all about the nipple. You know, it makes you just feel like you have breasts again.
So thank you very much for your time today, and I hope you learned something new about anaplastology. do we have any questions? I answered all the questions.
So with the children that you're working with, do you just size up as they grow older, or was that little girl's ear a little bigger so that she could grow into it, so to speak?
Good question. I do not size up. So the ear does continue to grow your entire life. Surgeons will scale up because that's supposed to last them their entire lives. But we replace these prostheses about every 3 years, especially when they're growing. But yeah, they just don't fit. They don't fit as well, and which means they don't glue on as well. So people like the security of it.
And then the man in the very beginning that had he made his own and then you made him one, and he just kind of had that opening.
Yeah.
Does your prosthesis have channels in it that breathe and let air exchange with hair or, you know, cilia kind of stuff, or no?
I do not put hair in the nose prosthesis or the ear prosthesis. But yes, they do have channels for breathing, and I can actually incorporate stents into the nose prostheses to help keep things open. Sir?
With multiple with defects on the ears, from surgery, from cancer, usually a big chunks out. Do you put a small chunk back in, or do you do the whole ear, or what do you do? Partial?
Partial ears. Yes, I do partial ears. And there's probably a lot more people that have partial ears than completely missing ears. They are a little bit trickier, but I can do them. And they oftentimes, imagine like a glove. The glove just slides onto your hand. I can make a prosthesis that slides on over the top of a partial ear, and it will stay on just like that. No glue necessary. So it's a little bit of a challenge in the fabrication, but it can be done. And sometimes, you know, I've even, when someone has, let's say, part of their cartilage that's involved in the Mohs surgery, I can even create a plug that just fills in that little spot. So, yeah.
One more question. Sorry. You're so few of you in the United States or around the world, how do you ensure that people follow in your footsteps to do what you're capable of doing?
How do I ensure that people follow in my footsteps?
Are there people interested in following you or being mentored by you so they can take your place when you retire?
Yeah, there are. My patient, I think, last week said, what happens when you die? Because I'm kind of the only person in Utah. A couple other people dabble, but I took offense to it. And, you know, it definitely could happen. There are not... We actually have a little bit more of, Utah's a little different. We don't have an oversupply, but most other states have an oversupply of anaplastologists, and they struggle to get enough patients. There's just not a large quantity of people that need my services. We could recruit people. The biggest need that I see with 500 people worldwide is those in other countries. They have most of the pretty much all the silicones in the world are made in the United States. And a lot of the specialized materials are made in the United States. So there are some real problems getting materials in other countries, especially countries like Cuba. They're 30 years behind us.
Recently enjoyed the movie The Darkest Hour, portraying Winston Churchill. I couldn't believe how they transformed the actor into someone who actually looked like Winston Churchill. Would this be an avenue for expression for your services? You did Abraham Lincoln. Is this a Hollywood kind of thing too?
Yeah, they are different materials. I have done some things for commercials and for a TV show. But it's kind of a hard business, you know. Money comes, and then you're dry for a couple of months. So, it's not something that I'm really interested in pursuing, I guess you could say. I find a lot more fulfillment in working with these patients. But I have a colleague who made Wolverine, who did the special effects for Wolverine, and then he came in. He was in Toronto, and then he just got tired of the business and became an anaplastologist. So there's a little bit of crossover between us all.
Oh, quick question.
Please.
With the burn victim.
Yes.
With the burn victim that you did his ears, did you offer to do his face, or was he fine with his ears, or?
I made a nose for him as well, which was in the picture, but I didn't mention it. He also is missing his hands. And I probably will make his hands for him because it's kind of a partial hand, and those are real tricky. At some point, these patients have to, come to terms with how they look or their, or even their new self. They have to come to terms with wearing a prosthesis, even. So I leave it up to them, and all the surgeons do. They just I'm here to help in whatever way they want me. So he was very happy with the ear prostheses I made, and then he asked me to make the nose. I didn't think it was worth it, but what do you do when they ask you? And so I made it for him, and I don't think he's wearing it, but So there are limitations. There certainly are. So, which brings up a point. I try to manage expectations. I don't tell people they're going to have their ear back or eye back. I show patients, and I showed you a lot of the good patients, but I show them a book of all the good patients and all the poor results that I've had too, because I want to manage their expectations and give them an idea of what they can expect in wearing a prosthesis.
Thank you. I'm going to take the liberty of one last question, Paul. Is a 3D printer going to put you out of business?
My wife asked me that same question. I do not think so, because I'm kind of on the forefront of 3D printing. So, and there's a lot of the fitting you can't take away, working with someone in person and all the expertise I have in fitting a prosthesis, because you read these news stories, there's tons of them out there. I did a story with KSL about 3D printing, and they said I was making ears already, and I'm like, no, I didn't do that. But I think there are some really cool technology coming out where the limitation with 3D printing right now is the materials. But pretty soon, I talked to a company just a few weeks ago where they can take different materials, like a two-component silicone, and they can 3D print in a silicone. It's kind of like printing the biogels for tissue engineering. So we have that potential, and I just hope that I'm doing that. So.